Greetings to all of God's people. This is Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 146, and we shall continue from the same verse we stopped at last time. And we were speaking about the subject of the Lord, the concept of the Lord, of Baal. And as God mentioned to Abimelech, that Sarah was Beulat Baal, that means she was owned by an owner. And that's an ancient terminology. And after that, from that Baal, people began to use also the name of the Baal, you know, the owner, the master. And that's basically, they use the same word. Of course, the Canaanites spoke a different language. In either case, it was a related one in those days. You know, many languages were pretty close, Semitic languages. And so Baal in Hebrew, Baal or Baal, it's all the same. In English, it's a Baal, but it's Baal, owner, master, that's what it means. And so they worshipped the master, they worshipped the Lord. And of course, they were worshipping the false one. And people have been doing it throughout the entirety of the false world, and to this very day. In the past 2,000 years, a lot of people come to the Lord. What Lord do they come to? Is it the true one or is it the false one? And many people believe, well, the Lord that they worship is the true one. And so they picture him. He may have long hair, you know, may have short hair, may have brown hair, may have blue eyes, he may have brown eyes, you know, he looks muscular to some and skinny and finky looking and, you know, in other words, all kind of images, and to all of these people, this represents the Lord, and of course, it's a false one. That person never existed. You see, and Baal was the same. It's a non-existent entity that people, you know, conjured in their own minds, and they applied it to the God of heavens, to the Creator. And the one that was dealing with humanity was the one that became Jesus Christ. And people are not aware to this very day. And so God tells them the day will come when He's going to cut off the name of Baal from the land. Now, the name of this false Lord. Because people are worshipping, you know, the false Lord, not the true one. And that's why they worship also the false doctrines, believing that they are the doctrines of that Lord. And they are not. And so Jesus Christ, looking at the disciples, and those who will come later on, and those who will come specifically in the last generation and appear before the throne of judgment, He tells them, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and you do not do what I say? You see, why do you call me Baal, Baal, master, owner? You see, if I'm your owner, as He said to His people Israel in chapter 1, He said through Isaiah, the ox knows his master, you know, he's Baal, Lord, owner. It's the same word. And you see, the donkey that is knows his master, and the ox knows, knows where to go to eat. But he said, my people don't know me. They don't know their master. The master that they know is a false one. They know a false one. And that one is the Canaanites referred to him was Baal, which means master, owner, lord. That's all it means. And in the prophets, God makes a point. The time will come when it shall not be so anymore. In Galatians in Galatians, the Apostle Paul was warning the people of his day, even in his own time, after he preached to them the true Lord, the true Master, the true Baal, the owner, you see, of the body. They went to another owner, another gospel, another Baal, you see. There's nothing wrong with the word Baal. Baal means owner, master, Lord. But when people go to the false one, then that's where the problem is. And some people want to think about the word Baal, they think it's an evil word, and it's not. Any woman in Israel calls her husband Baal. He's Baali, he's my husband. And he's called Baal HaBayit, the owner of the house, and she's called Baalat HaBayit in the feminine. There's nothing wrong, evil with that, nothing wrong with that. But when you take the false god and you pin this name on him, just like Aaron did, created the golden cow, and he told Israel, this is Elohim, you know, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. That's what the problem is. And that's when the first commandment, God says, you shall not make other Elohim beside me. In other words, I'm Elohim, yes, but I'm the only true one. All the others are false. And so it is Baal. It's no different than the word Elohim. You can have the right Elohim or the wrong Elohim, you know, the false one or the true one, or the true Baal or the false Baal or Baal. And in Hosea, this is what God says to His people. or the day will come, and he's going to totally prevent his people from misusing this terminology. When he speaks about his wife in Israel, and when he's going to bring them back, in chapter 2 of Hosea, in verse 6, he says, "Therefore, behold, I will hedge up your way with thorns and wall her in, so that you cannot find her path." In other words, he's going to bring a lot of problems on her, and they're going to overtake her. And as a result of that, in verse 7, in the middle, her response is, "Well, I will go and return to my first husband, my first Baal, my first lord, my first owner, master. For then it was better for me than now," you know, "now that I have a false one." And yet, this is what the people of Israel have been doing, forsaking the true Baal, the true owner, the true master, the true lord, and going for the false one. And so God gets to the point where he says, "I don't like this word anymore." You see? And so we read in verse 16, "And it shall be in that day, says the Lord," speaking about the future, "that you will call me my husband," or in Hebrew, "ishi," my man, "and no longer call me my master." That means Baali, my Baal. You see? He says, "For I will take from her mouth the names of the Baals, and they shall be remembered by name no more." You see, by their name. And to this very day, you hear everybody saying, "Lord, Lord, give your heart to the Lord. The Lord is good to me." What Lord are they worshipping? The true one or the false one? You know, God says, "You know, I'm just sick and tired of hearing people, you know, using this word." So that's why he's saying about his people Israel at the end time. Speaking about us who are alive today and all those who lived before that. Speaking about all those people, you know, that every Sunday and every day, you know, they use the name of the Lord. And all in vain. Because they're worshipping the false one. Just like the children of Israel, you know, they bow down before the golden calf and they say, "Oh, Elohim, Elohim, you know, you are our God." You see? Well, God is not impressed with that. And so it is the same with the Baal. Well, anyway, I thought I'll inject a few of these points here because they're relevant in that sense. And so when Sarah, being a married woman, that means she has a Baal. She has an owner, she has a master. You see, she has a husband. And therefore, it is illegal for somebody else to come and take that woman. And spiritually speaking, it's the same. When people worship God, from God's point of view, it is illegal for other people, for the deceivers, for the false prophets to come and take his wife, his people away from him, who is their Baal, their owner, their master, their Lord, and lead them to another Baal. You see, that's called idolatry. You know, just like adultery. And it's the same thing. So, adultery was contrary to the law, and idolatry was contrary to the law, because they're basically the same. And if a woman has a Baal, that's hers until his death. You know, of course, there are some other circumstances that the Bible deals with. And so Abimelech, understanding that, understanding the law of God, understanding the law that was still understood by many, many societies at the time, he said, "Well, I haven't done anything wrong. I'm innocent." And so he replies to God in verse 5, "Said he not himself unto me, she is my sister?" So if she's his sister, you know, he's not her Baal, and she's not his Beula. You see, later on you hear about the name Beula. Beula means married. Again in Hosea. And Isaiah, you see this terminology where God will bring back his people. He will call them married. You know, he said, "Your land shall be married, Beula." Some people that don't know what it means, they give that name to their daughters, Beula, which means married. Well, if she's a little girl, she cannot be Be'ulah, she cannot be married, so why do you give her, you know, that name? Because you don't even know what it means. No knowledge. As God would say in speaking about other issues, of course, he says, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge." We should know, you know, what we are reading. We should understand. And that's the purpose of studying the Word of God day and night until we come to the knowledge of understanding led by the Holy Spirit, you know, and illuminated by those who have a good measure of knowledge and understanding. There are many that can do it. It's not just one person. And all of us, as we continue to sit at the feet of Jesus Christ, of God, is going to bring us a greater knowledge and understanding, even on a personal basis, as we study His Word. And so this man says, well, she said that she's his sister, and therefore, you know, I shouldn't be guilty. And even she herself, both of them, they said, he's my brother. And see, both of them were not lying, but they were just not telling the whole truth, you know, just like Christ said. There are occasions where you're going to have to be shrewd as a serpent and harmless as a dove because of the way people are. So God was not, and you see throughout the whole account, God never held Abraham accountable for this, or Sarah. But on the other hand, they should have trusted in Him and be willing to go through the experience by telling the man, we're husband and wife, and we're the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and He can deliver us from your hand, you know, if you're going to do us any harm. And maybe they went through a moment of weakness, just like they did before they, you know, they went to Egypt. They did the same thing. And even then, at that time, God did not rebuke either one of them. And so He says, well, in the simplicity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this. That is, Abimelech says that. And from his point of view, from the point of view of the law, he was guiltless. Because he was, in that sense, deceived. But on the other hand, whether he was deceived or not, he did what he did, and that was wrong. Therefore, he was not without guilt before God. And that's why I said, you are good as dead. And so there are a lot of people who are sincerely, you know, they're sincere. They sincerely do certain things. They sincerely believe false doctrines. And so on one hand, they are guiltless in that sense because of their sincerity and innocence, because they've been lied to by those who call themselves servants of God, the servants of Jesus Christ. But on the other hand, since they're doing it and believing it and it's a lie, they're still guilty. So it's sort of guilty and innocent at the same time. And people like that, God will have mercy on them because in the innocence of their heart they've done it. Just like Paul said, yes, I've persecuted the church, I've done all those evil things, but I've done it in innocence. I thought I was doing, you know, God a service. A lot of people are doing that. You know, they think they're doing God a service and they do evil. And so they're guilty and innocent at the same time. And so God is merciful to their innocence and sincerity because they've not done it in malice. But on the other hand, He holds them accountable for it. Because what they've done was wrong. So sometimes we have to understand that. Just because we're sincere, that's totally, ultimately speaking, meaningless when it comes to the sin itself. But on the other hand, since God is a God of grace, when He realizes that we do it out of sincerity and innocence, we don't know our right from our hand, He's more merciful to us than to those who do understand better, as He told the Pharisees. You know, you claim that you have no sin, therefore your sin remains. That means you claim that you know the truth, therefore your sin remains with you. In other words, that's a different category of people. And these people will have a much harsher judgment than those who didn't know what they were doing. But still, all are guilty. And that's the point. And Abimelech was guilty. Because he, by taking the wife of a married man that had a master and an owner, so to speak, Baal, he was transgressing the law of God. But since he did it under circumstances where he thought that she was a sister, in that sense he was not. So he's sort of guilty and not guilty at the same time. And so God says unto him in the dream, yes, I know that in the simplicity, that is the innocence of your heart, you have done this, just like he knew that Paul did it in the innocence of his heart. Just like he knows that many of us, oftentimes we believe certain things, certain facts in our own minds are facts because we've been taught to read scriptures in a certain way, and we believe them all the time when we were wrong all along, and those who taught us were wrong all along. And so God is merciful to us, but nevertheless, we were wrong. You see, sincerely, but we were wrong. Man may sincerely walk into a minefield, and you know he does it in the innocence of his mind, but he pays the penalty anyway. And he wonders, you know, what happened? I thought I was doing right. Well, that's because we're guilty and innocent at the same time. And God wants us to be innocent, pure, you know, period, without being guilty at the same time. And that's why He commands us, grow in grace and knowledge. A lot of people don't want to grow in knowledge. They want to stay in the darkness in which they are. thinking, well, I'm frozen in time, that's it. I've got the truth, and I'm going to stick to it no matter what, and I'm not interested in learning anything else. God is not interested in that. Of course, we do not want to learn false information, supposed facts. But we want to grow in knowledge because we do not know everything. And it's very easy to be misled. And so God says to him, I know that in the simplicity of your heart you have done this, and I have withheld you from sinning against me. In other words, you've done wrong. You've committed in that sense adultery by taking a woman, though you didn't know it. And so I withheld you from sinning against me. And how you would have sinned against me now that he already had her as a wife? Well, obviously, consummating the relationship. And God just sort of, paralyzed him, and to the point that, as we read also with Pharaoh, they were just not able to perform. And they were not able to have children. And the women were barren. And so they realized there is something totally wrong here, It never happened to us before that. And now everybody is in this affliction. And that's how God withheld them from sinning against him, from going all the way. And so he said, therefore, I suffered you not to touch her. You see? So he brought all kind of calamities and afflictions on them to the point where he could not even get to that point. And of course, the touching he was talking is beyond just the touching, you touch with your hand. He's speaking about the act itself, of sexual act. And now, therefore, restore the man's wife. That's his wife, for he is a prophet. And he shall pray for you, and you shall live. And so now God is introducing his servant Abraham as a prophet. And all the men of old who worked with God, through whom God spoke, were also called prophets. And later on we read in, maybe we should go to that, in Psalm 105, where God is explaining this matter, speaking about the days of old, and is inspiring the psalmist to write that. And the psalmist writes this about Abraham in Psalm 105 and verse 7. He is the Lord our God, we read. His judgments are in all the earth. In other words, he looks at everybody on the face of the earth and he sees what they are doing. And if it is contrary to his will and he wants to intervene, he does. And that's exactly what he did with Abimelech. His judgments are in all the earth. And so he judged Abimelech and all of his household. And he brought the calamity on them as he did earlier on Pharaoh when he took Sarah. And he remembers his covenant forever. And then speaking about Abraham, the covenant that he made with Abraham and Isaac and so forth. And so in verse 13 we read, when they went from one nation to another, when there were few of them, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all those who were around them, from one kingdom to another. In this case, here we find ourselves with Abimelech, that is, Abraham is there, not us. But hopefully we're part of the story, if we take it to heart and becomes a living thing and not, an old ancient story that is not related to us. This is our father that we're talking about. And so whatever happened here relates to us too. And so, they went from one nation to another, from one kingdom to another, and he permitted no one to do them wrong. And Abimelech was about to do wrong here to Sarah, our mother. You see? And so he permitted no one to do them wrong. Yes, he rebuked kings for their sakes, and that's exactly what we are reading here. And he said to them, do not touch my anointed ones. And Sarah was one of his anointed too. And in essence, was saying to Abimelech, don't you dare touch her. In the manner that God knows how to make people not do that. And so he said, don't touch my anointed ones and do my prophets no harm. And this is Abraham in this case. And so this is what later on God is inspiring his people to write. How he was involved in every detail when it was necessary in the lives of his servants. And that's exactly what we see here. It says, he's a prophet. And he shall pray for you. And you shall live. Because he said you're going to be dead now. unless you repent of what you have done. Yes, you were innocent. You got to repent anyway. And that's why later on, when God brought Israel out of Egypt and brought them to Sinai and then instituted the Levitical priesthood, He gave them a special sacrifice of innocence. You see, asham. In other words, you're guilty of something you're not aware of, and the letter only found out, you know. So all the time we were innocent, you didn't know that you were doing wrong, but now that you found out, what are you going to do about it? And that's exactly how God confronts us every time. Okay, you didn't know until this point, be it a piece of information, a fact, doctrine, whatever it may be, an action that you have done, a wrong that you have done to your neighbor, your brother, your mate, whatever it may be, now that you know about it, you are made aware of it. Yes, you were innocent until this time. You didn't know that. What are you going to do about it? You see? And that's what God would always ask us. And when we come to the judgment seat, that's going to be the ultimate. What have you done about it? Once it came to your knowledge and understanding, then it's going to be a little bit too late for us. And so, this is what He's saying. He's going to pray for you if you repent, because He's a prophet, and you shall live. And if you restore her not, know that you shall surely die, you and all that are yours. And that's His whole kingdom. Everything that He owned. In those days, you know, the kings owned everything, everybody. At least, you know, all their servants and cattle, and the cattle of their servants, and all the possessions of their servants. And they were absolute dictators and rulers, so they owned basically everything that they ruled over. They could take anything they want. And so they'd all be dead. In verse 8, and Abimelech rose early in the morning. He was asleep, obviously. It wasn't a dream. And he rose early. He was not about to wait. In other words, that's the way we should obey God. He tells us to do something and we should rise early. And about Abraham, you see that oftentimes, whenever God gives him a command, or, you know, at times at night, he comes to him in a vision. Other times, He speaks to him in a person. But when He comes to him in a vision, it says he rose early in the morning and he did what God told him to do. And, you know, we must develop this habit. And Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told all these things in their ears, and the men were sore afraid. Now, you see, they're still aware of the true God of heaven and earth. And there was a measure of knowledge there and understanding. And they knew about Abraham. And they were not so far removed from truth as people became later on. A lot of people don't understand properly, you know, what idol worship is all about and how much information those people had about the God of gods, you know, the God of heavens and earth, and why Israel was so often prone, had the propensity, so to speak, to go toward idolatry, because they realize, you know, that among the idols there is one that is true, you know. So his name is Baal, or whatever other names. And we actually, you know, in their own mind, they would reason, we're really worshipping the true God, just like they did with the golden calf, you know. Okay, you know, God just spoke to us, but this is a representation of that God. You see, that's the reason why the false prophets were able to lead them astray. And they do it to this very day in other ways. You know, they give them facts and pieces of information that seem to be so similar to the truth, and they don't see anything wrong with that. And then they give them another piece of, or the wrong puzzle, you know, and they take it and they swallow it, and pretty soon they're in a totally different picture. And that's how Satan works, you know. He comes as an angel of light, a little bit here and a little bit there, you know, mixed with truth, and people think, well, that's the truth, I didn't see any difference. And just like some people say, well, you know, just because that guy, you know, is not keeping the Sabbath, you know, he keeps on Sunday, I don't see why he's less of a Christian than I am. You see, begin to reason like that, pretty soon, you know, you go all the way. There's no such a thing. If you follow Christ, and Christ kept the Sabbath, and He's the Lord of the Sabbath, and somebody doesn't keep the Sabbath, he's not of Christ. That's all there is to it. So a person that uses this kind of term, you know, this kind of reasoning, and you see a lot of them, supposedly children who call themselves the people of God, they obviously don't know their God. And that's how people were led into idolatry, and they're still being led into idolatry to this very day with this kind of false information. And so they end up worshipping the Lord. But who is that Lord? The true one or the false one? Who is that Baal? You know? And so it's very important for us to to be aware of this kind of matters. And it was very important for Abimelech to know who is the true lord of Sarah, the woman that he had taken. And so he rose early in the morning, he told his servants, and they were sore afraid. Then Abimelech called in verse 9 Abraham, and said unto him, what have you done unto us? And wherein have I sinned against you? What evil have I done against you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom? You see, he's not talking only about, you know, the few people around him, but his whole kingdom was going to be punished for that sin that he sinned against God, even though he was innocent, thinking that she was his sister. You have done deeds unto me that ought not be done. So he's rebuking him for it, because true, Abraham was still guilty on his part for not preventing. In other words, if we have an opportunity to prevent people from sinning by speaking the truth, we should. Otherwise, we deceive them. And there is a law that God gave Israel, and Abraham should have known it. You do not put a stumbling block, you see, before a blind person. And that's exactly what Abraham did here. This is the classic case of putting a stumbling block before a blind person. He knew what Abimelech would have done, and therefore should have prevented him from doing that. And we can read one of the laws that God gave concerning this matter also in Leviticus 19. You know, this is the chapter of the royal law. And verse 16 we read, you shall not go up and down as a talebearer among your people, neither shall you stand idly by the blood of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You see? You should not do all those kind of things. And then verse 17, he said, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. In other words, not allow him or not cause him to commit a sin. And that was not love on the part of Abraham toward Abimelech. You see, that's hatred. From the point of view of God, of course, he was not reasoning in that way. But that's what God is trying to explain to us. The spirit of the law tells us that if by your words you are causing your people, you know, other people to stumble and cause them to do wrong because you are afraid to say the truth, then you are guilty. And so that's what Abimelech is saying to him. You caused me to sin by not telling you the truth. Of course, Abraham had his reasons why he did it. He was afraid. And then Abimelech says in verse 10, and Abimelech said unto Abraham, what did you see, or what saw thou, that you have done this thing? In other words, what were you thinking about when you did it? And Abraham said, because I thought, surely the fear of God, or the fear of Elohim, and mind you, throughout this chapter, when God appears to other nations, to other people, generally people do not know God, he uses the word Elohim. And so throughout this chapter you see Elohim, you know, Elohim appeared to him. And he says, surely I thought Elohim is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake, because that was the custom and the habit. He knew that people do that, and Abimelech knew that also. So obviously he also had to understand why Abraham did what he did. And moreover, she is indeed my sister. In other words, I'm not really lying. She's the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And so she became my wife. And so, in essence, he's saying, well, and I was telling the truth, but not the whole truth, nothing but the truth. And so sometimes, you see what the problem is when we don't tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, somebody gets in trouble. But on the other hand, you know, God also allows us occasions where we don't necessarily need to tell everything. You know, somebody comes to your house, you know, with a shotgun and says, you know, where is your wife hiding? I want to kill her. Is she in the house? Well, you're not going to tell them, oh, yes, she's right here in the bedroom. Go over there and kill her. You see? And that's what Christ said. You know, there are times when you have to be short as a serpent and harmless as a dove. In this case, Abraham wanted to be sure as a serpent, you know, harmless as a dove, so he was telling the truth, but not the whole truth, and so you see how the whole thing became complicated, and yet God was merciful on both sides. And he says, she became my wife. And it came to pass when God caused me to wonder, and the Hebrew for here is when Elohim made me stray. In other words, it's not straying in the wrong sense, you know, in terms of sin. But, you know, I was in my own place and God told me, well, take a detour, go over there. And the word that he's using here, when Elohim caused me to stray, he uses in the plural. That is, Elohim is in the plural and then caused me in the plural also. And of course, the rabbis are scratching their head. Why is he speaking in the plural? Oh, okay, Elohim, we understand that now because, you know, we've seen it now many times. But why also caused me is in the plural? And obviously, what Abraham and what God is revealing here is he's dictating it to Moses, you see, as Abraham said it. Abraham, in essence, is revealing the fact that he's aware of the divinity of both. The one that is dealing with him on a personal basis, you know, the God that talks to him, that comes and eats with him and speaks to him and comes to him in a vision, and also the Most High. And so in essence, he's relating to Abimelech that these two divine beings were involved in his coming to this land. And that's another piece of the puzzle there for those who have eyes to see. The knowledge of the two divine beings was always there from the beginning. In other words, the concept of monotheism, as people came to think of it, was not a complete picture. Yes, there is a God that rules on this earth, deals with this earth, speaks to human beings, and he's the only one that does it. And all the other gods that people had, all the other Elohim, are false gods. So in that sense, that's monotheism. But it's not monotheism in the ultimate sense. Because there is one in heaven, he's not dealing with humanity. And so he's not, in that sense, the God of the earth, because he's not dealing with them. And he's not talking to them, so they don't know him. But still, there was a measure of knowledge and understanding there you know, among people. And that's one reason also why they came up with this concept that later on developed into a full-blown reality of idol worship. Many Elohim, you know, many gods. Because they knew about two, and then somebody said, well, what about three? What about four? And pretty soon there were many of them. And that's a sort of a hidden piece of information there. And of course, people do not see the whole picture. They don't understand it. So they scratch their head and try to reason around it. And that's exactly what you see in the commentary here. Once the eyes are blind, you know, people are confused. But of course, they're sincerely deceived because they've been taught lies. One of these days the eyes will be open, everybody will see, and it's going to be reality to all. There are two of them. They are not many and they are not one. And so that's what he's saying here. When Elohim made me, in the plural, to wander, or caused me to stray away from my father's house, that I said unto her, this is your kindness which you shall show unto me at every place, whether we shall come, say of me, he is my brother. Because then he realized what was the custom of the time. People knew you should not marry somebody's wife as long as he's alive. It's contrary to the law. You see, they were still obedient to the law. But if you can get rid of the man, you can marry them. That's exactly what Muhammad started doing. And he taught his people to do likewise. You know, you want somebody's wife, don't covet her. Kill the man. Then you can take her. And he himself did it. As a matter of fact, he killed several rich Jewish people with beautiful wives. And one of the wives, one of his most favorite one, I think she was the most favorite one, was a Jewish woman, the wife of the prophet. Of course, the Muslim, a lot of Arabs don't like to think about it too much, that, you know, the favorite wife of the prophet, their own prophet, was Jewish. And so he made a sort of a new law there, you know, in the Quran. And he told his followers that if you kill a man, marry his wife, either because you covet her, you desire her, and so you should do it the legal way. Of course, you know, what's legal when you kill the man? But think about one legality and forget about the other. But on the other hand, he said also, you should do it also because now that you killed her man, who is going to support her and her children, it should be your responsibility. In other words, he also put it upon them, if you are willing to kill a man, be willing to support his wife. Which is a very interesting mixture of truth and error, you know, kindness and cruelty. And that's not the way God is. So he said, this is my kindness, your kindness, that is, which you shall do unto me in every place where we go, where we come. When you see that people are, that nature, you see, when he went to Mamre earlier, the people were distant, so he didn't have to say that, didn't have to do that. At least we don't have any mention of that. But in places where people are not as honest as, they were violent, prone to do things like that, that was their defense. And she wouldn't be lying, and he wouldn't be lying, but, in the case of this Abimelech, you got a problem there. And so God came to his rescue there. And so Abimelech, in verse 14, took sheep and oxen and men servants and women servants and gave them unto Abraham and restored him Sarah, his wife. He's making a point. That's his wife. And his Isha. And Abimelech said, Avimelech, in Hebrew, Avi means father and Melech means king, father of a king, or king, the father's king. And he said, behold, my lord is, that is, sorry, behold, my land is before thee. You see? Now, Abraham, of course, Abimelech is not fully aware of that. Abraham is really the true owner of that land. It just wasn't given to him yet. And so he says, behold, my land is before you. Dwell there, that is, dwell wherever it pleases you. Now you're talking about the Philistines, who still have a measure of righteousness there, even in the days of Isaac, you still see that. They were not as evil as they became later on. And unto Sarah he said, behold, I have given your brother, he's sort of poking at her, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver, behold, it is for you as a covering of the eyes. What does it mean as a covering of the eyes? In other words, this is sort of an expiation for the wrong that was done. So, in other words, shut your eyes to the sin that I've done against you and against your brother. Cover your eyes. So that's what it means. When you give a bribe, you cause somebody to cover his eyes. So, in other words, I didn't see anything. That's a concept. And that's what he's saying here, covering of the eyes, to all that are with you, and before all men, that you are righted. In other words, I've done wrong to you, now it's right. I've taken care of it, and I expiated for it. I justified myself. In verse 17, and Abraham prayed unto God, and God healed Abimelech. In other words, if Abraham didn't pray, there would be no healing. And he prayed and healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, that is his concubines, and they bore children. In other words, God stopped Abimelech from touching Sarah, paralyzed him in one way or the other. We don't know exactly how. He couldn't go to his wife. He couldn't go to Sarah. He couldn't do anything. And all of his servants were in the same condition. They all realized something terrible happened here. And so when God came to him in the vision, and all of them knew what was happening to begin with, and then they all feared and realized, this is the God of Abraham that did it. For the Lord had, and it's very interesting here, only at the end of the chapter, you see the word the Lord, while all this time it was Elohim, because God is the one now dictating it to Moses, obviously. And it says, for the Lord, for Jehovah, has fast closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. And so you see how God intervenes literally in the little details or the big details of his servants, and especially when they are innocent in that case. And throughout this whole chapter, we don't see any word of rebuke that God leveled at either Abraham or Sarah, because they realize, they were afraid, but on the other hand, obviously, they should have been stronger in faith, and they should have asked him, or to begin with, they shouldn't go that close to those people. Well, God is merciful to all of us. He's graceful. He realizes that we are not there, all there, all the way. We gradually grow in faith, and then we come to the point where we don't do these kind of things. But until that time, God is merciful to us, and he doesn't hold it against us. But in either case, you see that Abraham was not outlying. He was really using the truth there, but he just was not saying everything. And so it was not malice or wickedness on his part in that sense. And then chapter 21, we keep reading, and the Lord remembered Sarah, as he has said, that is earlier, as he told her, you're going to have a son. And so that comes right at the heel of this episode here. And God obviously was interested in preserving her from being defiled, because the child of promise was going to come through her, you see, through Abraham. And he was not interested in any defilement happening here right before that. And so you see the intervention there. And the Lord remembered Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken, and Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son that was born unto him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. You know, laughter. That's because Sarah laughed. And he too was not too much in in believing God on this point. And he too was, sort of inwardly laughing at that. And he fell on his face before God, earlier, as we read. And verse 4, and Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old according to the law. So this is the first human being, and probably this is the first time it ever happened. If it happened before that, we don't know. There is no mention of it ever. It looks like this is the first time that God had done it. And so Isaac, the child of promise, is the first one, not even Abraham, is the first one to be circumcised on the 8th day. And he had a special position, Isaac. His reflection also of the one that will come later on, the child of promise, Jesus Christ. You see? That came out of an impossible situation where his mother was virgin. And here, Isaac is born out of an impossible situation where his mother was barren and an old woman. So you see the similarities there. And so, Jesus Christ is in essence the first circumcised person. You see, circumcised by the Holy Spirit. And from the beginning of life. As a matter of fact, he was from his mother's womb. So you see the similarities here. And Abraham circumcises Isaac, and he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. And Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born unto him. And Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. In other words, Isaac, that's what it means. Everyone that hears will laugh on account of me. Because it's funny. That's the humor of God. You're laughing. You got to call your son laughter, and then everybody's going to hear it and would want to know, why did you call your son laughter? You're going to have to explain it, and everybody's going to laugh. That's what he's saying here. In other words, we should never laugh at God. Whatever he says, no matter how quote-unquote funny it may sound. A lot of people think, that the people of God are funny people. And you know what they mean by that. And Sarah said, God has made me laughter, because everybody's going to laugh now on my account. And in essence, on the account of my own disbelief. And she said, who would have said unto Abraham that Sarah would give children suck? In other words, she's going to nurse. That's unheard of. For I have borne him a son in his old age. And the child grew and was weaned. And that generally happens at the age of 3. And people in the old days used to do it. They used to nurse children, 3 years old. And that's, in essence, all the age of maturity, that is maturity from babyhood. And also when God commanded Abraham earlier to bring those sacrifices, when he made a covenant with him, he said that each one of them should be 3 years old. The lamb and the ox and so forth. That sort of age of maturity. And Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne unto Abraham, making sport. In other words, that child, in essence, Ishmael, belonged to Sarah, according to the law. But Hagar was a mother, and Hagar still, apparently, has not learned her lesson from the past, and allowed Ishmael to develop this attitude, and he was developing this arrogant attitude toward Isaac. Of course, he's still a child, but he's not that young. This time, we were talking about a boy that was 16 years old. So he got a young punk, so to speak, teenage, smart aleck, And that was a bad thing that he did here. And of course his mother should have told him all along. You know, he doesn't get to this point just on his own. His mother put something in his mind that causes him to be that way. And so both she and him had to pay the penalty for it. But still, God loved him and Abraham loved him. And he still blessed him abundantly. And in verse 10 we read, "Wherefore she said unto Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son. For the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac." Why is she saying that? Because that's exactly what God said. When Abraham said, "Well, I don't have children," and he thought it was funny that God was telling him that he's going to have a child, he and Sarah, he said, "Why don't you take Ishmael?" First, you know, the first time he said, "Why don't you take Eliezer?" He became sort of like his son, adopted son. He was his servant, but he loved him very much and he was very faithful. And God says, "No, you're going to have a child yourself." And then he had Ishmael. And God said, "Well, why don't you take Ishmael and have the covenant through him?" And God says, "No, you're going to have a son from Sarah." And so Sarah knew very well that it is from Abraham and Sarah, and the covenant was made with both of them. Well, anyway, we're going to stop at this time and continue next time from this point. Until then, this is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people.